The Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute is hosting two intensive 9-day seminars for college students this July in Seattle. For details, visit discovery.org/sem. That's www.discovery.org/SEM. The first track is a seminar on intelligent design in the natural sciences, which prepares students to make research contributions advancing the growing science of intelligent design. The second track, the C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society, explores the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts. Applicants for each program must be currently enrolled in a college or university as a junior, senior, or graduate student. Students selected will be provided with course materials, lodging, and most meals. Travel scholarships are available and will be awarded based upon need after acceptance into the program. For application information and other seminar details, please visit discovery.org/SEM. That's www.discovery.org/SEM.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on the show Dr. David Snoke, a professor of physics at the University of Pittsburgh and also president and founder of the Christian Scientific Society. I believe this is your first time on ID the Future, Dr. Snoke, although we've certainly known of you and your work for a number of years, and I know that you've collaborated with a number of folks in the ID movement on various projects over the years, so it's really a pleasure to have you finally on the show here. We appreciate you coming on.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's good to talk with you, as always. Thanks for having me on.
Great. I'm looking forward to doing this podcast with you, Dr. Snoke, but before we get into it too much, maybe if we could just go a little bit into your background, Dr. Snoke, a little bit about who you are and why you're interested in this topic. So if you don't mind me asking, what got you interested in science when you were looking at what kind of a career you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question. I actually am one of the few people that I know who already in high school decided what he wanted to do and then pursued that all the way through and never changed. Lots of people I know switch careers, switch fields, and so on. I actually decided I wanted to go into physics already by the end of 10th grade and pretty much never left physics. And actually, at the time, I wasn't a Christian, and for me, the motivation of going into physics in the first place was because of feeling like I was going to understand the secrets of the universe, what the universe was all about, and be a big thinker about the basic issues. In some sense, the same thing that took me to physics was what also took me to Christianity, as I started to ask the deep, big questions about life. And what happened was I became a Christian at the end of high school, going into college, and when I was actually studying physics as an undergrad, I quickly realized already by the end of undergrad that physics was not going to provide the ultimate questions that I was asking. But I was encouraged by a number of people to stay in physics, and I've really enjoyed it. There are some really great fundamental questions that are asked in the context of physics. And one of the reasons why I stayed in it was really to be able to have a Christian voice to talk about these things with some level of understanding what is really going on in the science world.
So what kind of research do you do at the University of Pittsburgh?
I guess I would characterize it as experimental fundamental quantum mechanics. I run an experimental lab. We have a whole bunch of lasers, ultrafast lasers, cryogenics, and different things like that. And what we're doing is not primarily trying to make new devices. We're actually looking for fundamental quantum mechanical effects in the different things that we're looking at, mostly with optical methods. In a nutshell, you could say, you know, one of the basic effects that we're looking at is seeing quantum mechanics on a macroscopic scale. A lot of people have the impression that quantum mechanics only applies at the microscopic scale. When you get to the macroscopic scale, you know, it all washes out and you don't need to worry about quantum mechanical effects. And actually, that's not true. There's a lot of systems where you can see wave behavior of matter even at the macroscopic scale. And so that is one of the things that we investigate, and we do that with, again, mostly the optical methods. And on the side, I also do a fair amount of theory as well, collaborating with different people on basic fundamental questions of quantum mechanics.
Could you give us an example of a macro system where you can observe quantum mechanics effects?
Well, the canonical example is what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate. And what happens is in a number of systems where the particles are what are called bosons, which is a class of particles, it's not a specific type of particle. When you cool it down to a low enough temperature, a substantial fraction of the particles will jump into a single quantum state. So this is what underlies superconductors, which some people are familiar with, which have zero resistance, low temperature. It's also what underlies superfluids, liquid helium that flow without any friction. And then there's more exotic systems, like the things that we're working on, where we actually take photons, which are particles of light, and get them to act like little atoms and to self-organize into one of these Bose condensates. So it's actually become a very active topic in the experimental world in the last 20 years. There was a groundbreaking work that was done on this in the mid-90s, which led to a couple Nobel Prizes, and just a very active field working on this these days.
Now, I have to ask this question because this has been a big story in the news recently that computer scientists are looking to develop quantum computers based upon the principles of quantum mechanics so they can break codes and kind of attack those questions that require huge numbers of computations. Mm-hmm. So is your research at all relevant to those kinds of questions? Either way, what do you think are the prospects of developing quantum computers? I'm really curious in your take on this.
Yeah, well, my work is relevant to that. And actually, at Pitt here, we just started in the past few years something called the Pitt Quantum Initiative, which is a group of us in experimental physics who are working on related questions. I guess I would say the common approach of people in experimental physics that are working on these types of things is that there's a lot of really interesting fundamental questions that are being researched in this area, but I wouldn't hold my breath on a quantum computer being ready in the next 5 or 10 years. You know, there's a lot of really basic questions that still need to be answered. But I think the general feeling in the field is that it's not just a pipe dream, that this is a reality that could come to exist. And when we talk about a quantum computer, we're not just talking about a computer where the parts obey quantum mechanics, because like everything obeys quantum mechanics at a small enough level. But we're talking about a computer in which actually fundamental properties of quantum mechanics make a difference in how the computer works. So you're directly using the wave nature of things in the gates that control the computer itself. And so the physics is real, but there's a lot of technical issues which still need to be resolved. So even though the physics is real, there's a lot of technical things that make this something that would be more like 20 years off, not 5 years off.
Well, I find this really fascinating. I did a fair amount of computer programming back in my college, high school days. And I think the prospect of quantum computing, I mean, it's quite striking what some of the possibilities are, what could be done. I mean, I remember trying to create a program that would just model some of the gravitational interactions of bodies in the solar system. We were thinking about doing a project like that till we realized that, oh my gosh, some of these kinds of questions are not solvable by computers, the gravitational interactions of lots of bodies. You can't do that. But to think of what you could do with quantum computers is really exciting.
Yeah, and there's also people who will argue that maybe the brain involves some kind of quantum computing as well. And that's very hypothetical, because basically nobody really knows how the brain works. But there are some, you know, really fascinating questions that get raised in this area.
Yeah, imagine that. We might be quantum computers. We might already be walking around. Maybe my cat has a quantum computer inside of its head. Who knows? Okay, well, that's fascinating stuff. Let's turn now to the topic of intelligent design. How did you get interested in the topic of origins in intelligent design, and maybe what drew you, to keep this on a scientific level, what drew you scientifically to ID as a scientific question that could be asked?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess at two levels. First, I would say that anyone who is a Christian in science gets asked questions all the time about origins. I mean, it's just, you know, one of the classic questions that gets asked. And I've sort of swung back and forth between getting tired of addressing only that one issue and exploring other issues like the mind-brain question and so on. But it certainly is one that everybody in science gets asked their position on, so I felt like I had to be somewhat informed on that. But I'll tell you what actually, you know, in practice got me more involved was back in the 80s when I was a grad student. I started reading books by various authors such as Paul Davies and Frank Tipler talking about all the cosmic number coincidences and the fine-tuning issues in nature. I think actually one of the first articles written on this was by the very famous Dirac, who was one of the founders of modern quantum mechanics, raising these issues of the fantastic coincidences just to make it possible for life to exist. And so already before I was involved in any ID circles or anything like this, I was just reading these things and saying, yeah, this is really good physics and it's really fascinating. And then probably one of the earliest books I read was Hugh Ross's Fingerprint of God, which to me the wonderful thing was how he was addressing the exact same physics issues that I had already been reading about in secular circles. And then shortly after that, of course, in the 90s came this whole series of books, right, by Michael Behe and Phil Johnson and so on, questioning evolution. And in my mind, I didn't really see a sharp distinction between the cosmological fine-tuning arguments and the biological fine-tuning arguments. They all seemed to me sort of the same kind of cloth to say, well, you can always imagine some incredible coincidence, but at some point, our ability to believe that it really was just a coincidence breaks down when the odds become so ridiculous. And so that sort of led me into looking at a lot of the biological things. A book that really had a huge influence on me was Barrow and Tipler. It was mid-80s, I think. But that was a book by two very well-known physicists who, in a single book, talked about both the cosmological fine-tuning problem and the biological fine-tuning problem, and solid physics and statistics all the way through. It's kind of a dense read. It's not really a popular book that a lot of people would be able to follow. But that made a lot of waves in the physics world. And in general, I would say in the physics world, talking about origins, cosmological questions, so on, is fair game. I mean, we do a lot of thinking about where do we all come from and where are we all going. And so, you know, Barrow and Tipler's book wasn't universally accepted, but it was certainly viewed as an interesting contribution in the physics world. And so, yeah, I just had a lot of people in the physics world that we were talking about these things and the whole fine-tuning issues and so on. I'll tell you just one last story. This was probably around 92. I read a review article in Scientific American, and I believe it was by a science writer of theirs, last name of Horgan, in which he talked about panspermia and how the, you know, origins of life on the Earth problem was so difficult that a lot of serious thinkers were saying that it was actually created by space aliens who brought it to Earth. And when I read that in Scientific American, I was like, okay, you know what, I'm not embarrassed of anything on the Christian side. You know, this is kind of nuts. And that just led me to be pretty open-minded thinking about a lot of these things. And in general, I kind of think of myself as a paradigm questioner. I like to shake the cage and think about things from different sides. And so I was pretty open to reading a lot of stuff on the ID side.
I think people who are trying to resolve these questions, they're going to get into bigger picture issues. And so if they're allowed to talk about panspermia, or frankly, if they're allowed to talk about there being absolutely no design in nature, then we should be able to explore similar alternative, but opposing hypotheses, I suppose. And I really like what you said also, that you saw the evidence for fine-tuning at the macro scale in nature. And once you accept that, why should there be such a barrier to accepting fine-tuning at the micro scale? I think that makes a lot of sense. I've heard folks, I think, sort of intuitively say that before, but you put it quite explicitly. And I really like the fact that you've seen that connection, that fine-tuning in one area, why can't we have fine-tuning in another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, actually, one of my earliest exposures to this type of argument was at Cornell, taking a biophysics class as an undergrad. And the professor, whose name I do not remember, might even have been an adjunct faculty or something, but he was a Jewish man who was constantly pointing out all the wonderful fine-tuning in all of the different processes. You know, quantum mechanical tunneling is an intrinsic part of certain biological processes like respiration. And quantum mechanical tunneling rates have exponential sensitivity. If you change certain aspects slightly, you get exponential amplification of the rates. And so if certain rates were a little bit faster, we would all burn up in the respiration process. And if they were a little bit slower, we would all be inert. And so he was excited about pointing out all these fine-tuning things. And this is like 1982. And I, to this day, do not remember the name of that professor, but it was very inspiring to me.
Well, this is a very fun conversation, Dr. Snoke. But unfortunately, we're running out of time for this first podcast. So we'll have to come back for more with Dr. David Snoke here on Eye to the Future. I'm Casey Luskin. Stay tuned for more, and thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.